Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. If you read the Thread newsletter, you know that I came to Rumen Alem's novel with a fair amount of skepticism. I wasn't convinced that I needed to read more about millennials and their Manhattan-based adventures and angst. But from the beginning, it was clear that Mr. Alem had cracked the code of the loving conflict that often characterizes close friendships between young women. One of the friends realizes people grow up, become interested in new things, new people. But Lauren is a part of her world, and she is a part of Lauren's. As Mr. Alem joins us, I think it'd be interesting to hear from you on those bonds of friendship you formed or are forming now in your 20s, because I think that's a unique time for friendship. So if you're in your 20s, or you remember back to your 20s, did you share an experience in your 20s, or are you in the midst of one right now that is forging a strong bond with a friend? Maybe you've traveled with a friend. Maybe that's where the deep bonds of the friendship were really forged. Maybe you moved to a new place together. Maybe you just encountered one another in an unexpected place, and it meant that a friendship formed. What does that bond mean to you? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can tweet me about it. It's at Carrie NPR. Rumen Alem's novel is titled Rich and Pretty, and he joins us today from New York City. Good morning. It's really good to have you with us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're not going to be surprised when I say, where does a 30-something same-sex partner, dad of two kids, get so much insight about friendship between women? Where does that come from?
I'm delighted to hear that you were skeptical and that I managed to kind of defeat your skepticism.
You won me over completely.
I'm so proud. Thank you. That's very high praise. I think the novelist's task is to the writer of realistic fiction, as I am, their task is to try to capture some truth in people. And it doesn't really matter if the people are like them or not like them. The task remains the same. And I found myself talking a lot about this because there is a lot of interest in the fact that I'm a man and I wrote a book about women. And the answer that I've come to that surprised even myself is that there are many writers who write convincingly about life on Mars or sentient animals. That is simply the work. And in many ways, I had it easier than someone who's writing about life on Mars because I've lived my life around women. And women are not so different from men, however, whatever differences there are. So it's not so much of a stretch.
Here's what really struck me, though, about what you got. You understood that what looks like fragility in a friendship, you know, the pettiness, the competition, I mean, I really understand this as somebody who's held friends pretty close, you know, through my 20s, 30s, 40s and beyond, that really just reinforces the friendship bond. It's not a break in the friendship. It's kind of cement in the friendship. That's the nuance that I think you really got.
Well, I'm happy to hear you say that. Thank you. Well, the truth is I'm a terrible, terrible thief, as all writers are. And I sit around, I'm 39 now. And so I've spent a lifetime watching the relationships and lives of the women, mostly women, in my life. And again, the line I sort of say is that I've always been friends with women. I've always worked for women and alongside women. And so I've had a lot of time and exposure to the intricacies of lives that are different from mine. And I just stole it, basically.
There's a place where Sarah, one of the friends, is worried that, and this is the line, quote, on some level, Lauren is jealous. That's the kind of thing that that I think comes up in women's friendships. And again, I want to say that does not undermine a friendship often. It kind of cements a friendship. But I know that that's not a quality that is often present as it is in a female friendship, as it is with men. Not that there isn't competition between men, but you know what I'm saying about the differences.
Sure. I suppose the archetype would be that men sort of would be competitive on a basketball court or in an office environment, but that when it came to this sort of subtle nuance of who's going to get married first, that that matters less somehow to men. And I don't know. I don't know if that's true. It's like it's a risky pronouncement to make.
It is.
But certainly the specific subtlety of what you and I are talking about in the relationship in these two protagonists, the fear that the one who is going to get married worries that the one who isn't is on some level jealous, that felt accurate to me, and I'm happy that it felt accurate to you.
Which, by the way, isn't necessarily the case. The one getting married may be utterly misreading the perceptions and the feelings of the other one. And the
Absolutely.
Other one may be very aware. Now we
Absolutely.
Are really in the weeds of female friendship.
Absolutely.
But the one that isn't getting married may be fully aware that there's a perception of that between these friends.
Absolutely. It's a very complicated, you know, I mean, often the things that we assume are going on in the lives of other people are things that we are focused. It says more about us than it says about the other person.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well said. Here's a call from Renee in Minneapolis. How are you thinking about this, Renee? Hi.
Hey, good morning, Carrie.
Hi.
So I'm in my mid-40s. Mm-hmm. And as you were describing just the being in your mid-20s and having these experiences, I'm a marriage counselor, and so I'm all about relationships.
Uh-huh.
And I recently had, I was really contemplating what some recent developments in a friend's life. So when I was in my 20s, I lived in Los Angeles for about a year, and I had a roommate, and we lived together for probably about 6 months of that year.
Mm-hmm.
And what we experienced at 25 as young professionals, I grew up in Wisconsin, she grew up in Michigan. We had this group of friends. It was pretty amazing and incredible. We both left Los Angeles, but we stayed in touch. I went to Chicago before I moved here, and she's in Boston. And we did not see each other often, you know, when she got married or when I went out there for business or she came to Chicago or Minneapolis for business. But what struck me is when we would get together, it was like those old friendships from growing up that you just wouldn't even miss a heartbeat. And it was amazing to me how, and it still is, how tight we stay together. And she, in May, was diagnosed with breast cancer. And the support and just our connection and what we get out of each other when big life events happen,
right.
It's pretty incredible. And I have another relationship like that with another woman. Crazy enough, was diagnosed with breast cancer also in May. And the connection, I didn't live with her, but we were friends in Chicago. I was in her wedding, and we haven't seen each other. But it's quite amazing, I think, how the experiences that you have during that growth period really have impacted me, at least, through my 30s and 40s and the relationships with those women.
You know, Renee, since you're a marriage counselor, I've been thinking about this because we did a show recently about friendship. Is there something about, is it more that it's such a novel time in our lives, in our 20s, when things are changing so much and we're having new experiences? Or do you think there's something about marriage that changes the way you're going to interact and you're going to form that bond with a new friend?
Well, boy, if you had an hour, I could probably go on.
maybe I should have an hour on this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'd be more than happy to talk about it. But I do think, you know, science and neurology shows that, you know, our brains are developing until we're about 25, 26 years old, right? And so we're going through all of these amazing changes. I think our parents used to get married when they were 19, 20, 21.
Right.
We're going through all of these changes and experiences if we're fortunate and lucky enough. So I think that there's an individual component to it. And I think there are people, of course, that then, you know, gravitate to establishing a partnership or a marriage in their mid-20s. And I think that can pull then in a different route, too, and have an impact on your personal relationships, your friendships, because you only have so much of the pie that you can divide up.
All right. So Renee, we're going to get your contact info off air, okay? Because I think there's more to say on this. I really appreciate the call. Ruman, does that resonate with you?
You know, what's funny is that I just finished reading a wonderful book called All the Single Ladies by the journalist Rebecca Traister. And Rebecca's book really talks about precisely that, that in a culture where it's normal for people to get married in their 30s, and we're talking about a generation whose mothers may have, it was the expectation was that they married at 19, 20, 21, 22, that there is this sort of fundamental development that happens in your early 20s that used to happen alongside your spouse and now often happens alongside your intimates.
It's true.
You know? And I think that is sort of what the caller was talking about. And it's funny, when I was writing this book, I assiduously avoided reading any kind of work that addressed this particular subject. Rebecca's book came out a year later, but I just read it because she and I are doing an event together, and it was remarkable for me to look at a piece of journalism and feel that it so closely informed the novel that I had just written. I feel like I'm writing about precisely what Rebecca's writing about.
And I feel like I have been, for some reason, steeped in this idea of what friendship is. We did a show last week or 2 weeks ago about this new study that came out from MIT about the reciprocity of friendship.
Uh-huh.
And then I happened to be reading another novel by Jackie Woodson, who's going to be on the show soon. Have you read that? Oh, my gosh.
It's on my list.
So good.
I heard it's amazing.
And then there's your novel. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think we live in a culture that has evolved away from a very strict definition of the family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, our understanding of what a family is has broadened, and rightly so. And I think that there are many, many people, myself included, who consider our friends as part of our family. And I think that intimate relationship, it makes sense to me that friendship would be a great subject for the fiction of our time period, just as the fiction of a previous time period was very concerned about sort of family saga or the marriage plot, you know?
Yeah, makes sense. So one of the big takeaways from that show on friendship for me, from our guests, was, I mean, you saw that it was reciprocity. I'm more invested in the friendship than, you know, other people perceive that they are. But here, one of the big takeaways for me was, so often, apparently, people feel like they are giving so much more to the friendship than they're getting back. So listen to what one of our guests said about that.
So it is tricky being friend in the best of situations, and then you add in one person having needs that our friendship hasn't practiced yet, and it is just almost guaranteed that we're going to mess up and not be perfect at this. When I'm speaking in front of an audience and I'm talking about the healthy friendships, you know, if there's 1,000 people in the room and I ask them, how many of you feel like the giver in the relationships? 90% of the hands go up, possibly 100% sometimes. I mean, it is just, we all have this feeling of being the one who gives more in our friendships. And so I think this conversation is, interestingly, to broaden it even more and to say, this is fascinating that we live in a world where most of us feel like the giver. So when we do have a need, it's more offensive and hurtful for us to be like, we can name all the things we've done to help that person. And it feels very like a betrayal to not have people know what we need, step in and be able to participate in that. And I have numerous theories on that, but I think one of the things we can do in our friendships is to really make sure, as women especially, that we're practicing receiving all throughout our friendship.
So do you feel like you're more the giver, Ruman, if you were really honest about it?
Goodness. Wow, that's an impossible question to answer without, you know, you sort of don't win no matter how you answer. But I think it's akin to...
But with candor, I really want to...
I suppose so. I suppose that we are all... It's akin to what I said before, that we sort of... What we think other people are doing is really what we ourselves are doing. And the feeling... It's a self-interested feeling of saying, oh, I'm always giving... Oh, I don't know. I don't know. That's a tough question. But, you know, I guess I would turn that around and say, are we as practiced at actually accepting affection and help from our friends?
Mm.
And that is something that I felt in the relationship I was dramatizing in the novel, where I think that Lauren, who is one of the title friends, is maybe not so adept at actually accepting her friend's affection.
Exactly.
And that's part of the problem, you know.
Maggie says on Twitter, I was in my best friend's wedding shortly after I went to rehab, and 6 months into my recovery, she got pregnant. We share a new life now. And to the phones to Anne in Minneapolis. Hi, Anne. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Carrie. Yeah, I wanted to speak on my friend because when I moved to Minnesota in 1987, I lived in a town there wasn't any white people, you know. It was kind of separate, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved here, I met her probably, I want to say 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a bartender, a Caucasian woman, and she rode motorcycles like me. And we just bonded right away. Even though I felt like that we are not going to speak the same language, we're not going to be able to, you know. But for some reason, and she's my best friend now. We even made when we were younger and our kids were younger. If I told her, if I die, I want you to raise my children. And she said the same thing to me.
And so all these years later, all those differences...
Yeah.
The friendship has sustained.
She's my sister. Not only I call her my sister. That's how close we are. When my mother passed away, she held my hand through the whole process. And even after, she would call me in the middle of the night. And it'd be like she was psychic. She'd know that I was sitting crying. You know, she just has this connection with me. And I have the same connection with her when she's going through things. And do you know we've never had an argument?
Now, that's pretty unusual.
Never.
It is. You are both wise women if you can avoid
yeah.
the arguments. And I love the call. I'm so glad you were listening today.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Ruman, do you have a friend like that in your life?
You know, I don't know that I do have a friend who I feel is so different from me. But I love that story because I think it underscores that chemistry is a real mystery, and that what can bring two seemingly disparate people together, you know, who knows? And that caller felt a closeness that was almost like that you would feel with a sibling. I think that's not uncommon and really wonderful, and one of those things that is such a mystery. I think in my novel, the protagonists become friends at 11, at age 11, and purely by happenstance, they I think it's that they sit near each other at the orientation on the first day of school. And I'm really struck by the randomness of that I could be friends with somebody who whoever assigns college dorm rooms could have happened to assign me to live next door to somebody and then I could be the best man at their wedding 10 years
exactly.
later, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to, if you've just tuned in, we're having a conversation with Ruman Alam about his new novel, Rich and Pretty. It's part of our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series. You can read all about it on The Thread. But this is interesting. I want to pick up on something that Ruman and Anne, our callers, said, and I'll adjust this a little bit. If you have a friend and you met them, you know, in your teens, even before that, maybe in your 20s, and they are a friend that, as Ruman suggested, have become like family to you. I mean, your family has reached out to embrace this friend. I'd like to hear about that. I'd like to hear about what that bond means to you today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Ruman, I wanted to say something here because you were mentioning about family and friends and how we define family differently. Because I read the piece that you wrote for the New York Times on Father's Day,
mm-hmm.
and it's called Two Dads, Two Kids, One Experiment in Family. And you wrote, when gay men and women marry and build conventional families, we become something other than the outsiders we've long been. It's a privilege to be welcomed by a society that's suspicious of our kind, even if there's pushback from our gay peers who don't want to walk down the aisle or push strollers. I take the point. Respect should not be reserved for those who adhere to some notion of convention. Where's the pushback come from?
You do hear occasionally from gay and lesbian people that their goal in life is not a sort of liberty that echoes the liberty of their straight brothers and sisters, that they want to make a life on their own terms as, you know, single gay men and women who are not defined by getting married or having children. Mm-hmm. And I see the truth in that, and that in many ways, I always joke about my own family that we have this sort of Eisenhower-era family where we got married, a year later we had a baby, 3 years later we had another baby, mm-hmm. that we sort of adhered to this very post-war model of the American family. And that was our choice. And no one should be forced to adhere to that particular structure anymore. It's 2016. And if your family, as you define it, is, you know, your career and your dearest friends, if your family is your siblings, if your family is your spouse, those should all be equally valid.
Jim in St. Paul called with a thought for you and a question. He says, does Ruman have anything to say about why relationships between gay men and straight women can become so strong? He says, I had a close relationship with a straight woman. Though it fell off when she got married, I've always been curious about this kind of friendship. I don't know. Any insight on that?
Huh. That is such an interesting question. I think certainly when you have a relationship, it's easier, I think, to achieve a level of intimacy when you take sexual attraction out of the equation. And so if that question of sexual attraction doesn't exist, it seems like it's easier to become sort of very close in a platonic way, let's mm-hmm. say. But yeah, there is certainly an archetype of a friendship between a gay man and a straight woman. And I'm not really sure where that comes from. I think I wonder if it doesn't come in part from the socialization. When I think of when I was a little kid on the playground, and I knew that I was gay on some level, I gravitated towards female friendship or friendship with girls because it felt safer. And mm-hmm. so I wonder if some of that is just a holdover from a desire for safety as a child.
Safer because you didn't think there was going to be judgment or...
Yeah, yes. And, you know, what's remarkable is that, you know, I was born in 1977, and this was not that long ago in the big scheme of things, but things have really changed in this particular way. And now it is possible and indeed not uncommon, I think, to have 12, 13-year-old boys and girls who are open about being gay, which is quite remarkable. And that was sort of unthinkable when I was a kid.
Call here from Nicole in Detroit Lakes. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Carrie.
Hey, glad you called. What are you thinking about?
Well, I just wanted to comment on a friendship that I found in my 20s. I met a woman on an online message board for parents of kids with special needs mm-hmm. and found out that she and I happened to live in the same small town.
Hmm.
And so we got together and met, and she was a really close friend kind of right from the start. I mean, it's just something when you have kids with special needs, it's something that is kind of a bond that hard to find with other friends that just don't understand what you're going through. And she was an adoptive parent, and she inspired me to then adopt a child with special needs. And we did that in 2013.
Wow.
And a year ago, that little boy passed away.
Oh.
And she has been there for me, I guess, in a way that, you know, I couldn't have ever imagine that a friend could be. And it's just really neat to see kind of the full circle, you know, the way that we became friends seemed kind of just really happenstance that, you know, we would become friends and meet that way. And then just to have her, you know, be able to kind of walk through some really tough stuff in my life. And I have other close friends, but we, you know, just aren't as close anymore. They've not experienced, you know, some of those same things. And I think your friends change when you go through certain things in life, and I think parenting kids with special needs is one of those. I have found that many parents of kids with special needs, you know, really don't have a lot of close friends outside of other parents of kids with special needs, because it's just a bond that's really hard to, you know, for other people to understand. So,
you know, Nicole, the other thing that I hear in that is how influential you've been in each other's lives.
Yep.
I mean, if you really look in your circle of friendship, and Ruman, I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. You have friends that, for whatever reason, as you said, chemistry, shared experience, but there are those two or three friends I find that really influence your life, can help you make a difficult decision, can set you on a path you didn't know you were going to be on.
Yes. Goodness, I'm so sorry for your loss. That's heartbreaking. But I think it's so fascinating that you discovered this intimate connection on the internet. And there's a sociologist whose name I now cannot remember, which is maddening, but he wrote a wonderful book called Bowling Alone, and it's about the sort of decline of institutional life in this country.
Somebody will tweet it in instantly, I'm sure.
But it's sort of about the decline of institutions like labor and the church. And I think the internet is such an interesting response to that people have found like-minded people online and in many cases forged relationships that are very real, even if they never meet face-to-face, and that really affect the lives that they build. And I think that's remarkable.
You know that there's a lot of hand-wringing, though, over, you know, the quality of friendship, that when you can friend somebody instantly on Facebook, you're losing the essence of what friendship really ought to be.
But who's to say what the essence of a friendship is, except for the two people participating in it? You know, I can understand. I frankly, to me, it's like online dating. When I have friends who are I was just talking to a friend who's single, and we were talking, and somebody in the group said, "Oh, are you online?" And she said, "Yes." That question is so dated. If you are single and looking, you are online. Like, that is how it works these days. And I think that's true and not invalid. I think that, I've met a lot of people on Twitter, weirdly, a lot of colleagues, people I consider colleagues now on Twitter, and I haven't always met them face to face. And those relationships are very gratifying. I mean, those are not my best friends in the universe, but I don't think that discounts the level of intimacy, you know?
Tell me candidly here, do you feel a little measure of secret superiority that you have found your David and you don't need to be online and you are removed to some degree from that world?
In terms of romance, well, I wouldn't say superiority, but I would say tremendous relief, because I do think it's very hard to meet people. And I met my husband. We were introduced by a mutual friend, and I was so skeptical when she said, "Oh, I met somebody I think you would like," because I was just, you know, I was very skeptical, and I didn't necessarily think I would actually have, a wedding. And I always knew I was going to have children, but I didn't necessarily think I was going to have a partner for life. And so, yes, I wouldn't say that I feel smug about it, but I would say I feel very lucky.
Did you hear what you just said, though? A mutual friend. This is just what I was talking about, the way friends can influence the
absolutely.
Rest of your life.
Absolutely.
Right?
And this was a wonderful woman who I worked with, who she moved away and I don't see her very often, but I will forever think so fondly of her because she changed the entire course of my life.
Jeez. To the phones to Bridget in St. Cloud. Hey, Bridget, where did you meet your best friend?
Hi, yeah. I met my best friend in the sixth grade when our two elementaries combined to one school. And we found a bond in each other immediately. We're kind of like two peas in a pod, where we even look similar, act similar. We, you know, got into like lighthearted trouble together when we were young, and our bond together has just been so amazing and so close that we can take months apart from not speaking to each other, and when we see each other, talk to each other, we're back on that same page, just as like the other caller earlier was talking about. So I'm forever grateful to have her in my life, and we connect immediately and forever. But I have kind of a two-sided experience of friendship. And now that I'm 31 and recently married and recently had a son, I'm having troubles connecting and making strong bonds with my peers now, because I feel like a lot of people are in their own, bubble or connected on social media, where a lot of the friendships are really topical and more acquaintance-like, and getting frustrated in my own life that people are disconnected from the relationships and building like strong bonds that way. So yeah. I've had a different experience with, you know, meeting and connecting with people, even trying to like take a birthing class and hoping to meet people there who are in my same experience or about to have their firstborn. And as we take breaks, everyone's on their cell phones checking Facebook updates and such.
Hey, Bridget, I'm going to do this because this came up in that friendship show. If you can find it on the podcast, if you podcast, look for NPR News with Carrie Miller on iTunes, and it's the show on friendship. And, geez, I think we just did it, I don't know, either last week or the week before. And this exact thing about what happens when you're having kids and some of your friends aren't, and how do you maintain those bonds. So I recommend the show to you. Ruman Alam is with us this morning. We're talking about his new novel, Rich and Pretty, which explores the friendship of two young women in New York City going through rites of passage, but at different times and kind of different passages, I guess, and what that says and what he understands about friendship. Would you mind reading a few paragraphs from?
Sure.
This is an area. This is where Sarah is one half of this friendship that we've been talking about, considering this friendship with Lauren. Is that an okay way to set it up?
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Lauren, whom she's always known and understood so well, suddenly seems a mystery. Things change in life. Of course they do. People grow up, become interested in new things, new people. Our way of being in the world is probably a lot less fixed than most people think. But Lauren is part of her world, and she's a part of Lauren's. She knows this. The circumstances have changed over the years, of course, but that fact has remained. They've fought. They've grown apart. Those first few years, after living as roommates, it had been Lauren who wanted a place of her own and seemed to begrudge every dinner invitation. There was always some guy. Then there had been Gabe, whom Lauren had put at the very center of her life. Sarah had been jealous, but that had passed. She continues to tender the invitations, to make the telephone calls, and Lauren continues to answer them. They have a good time together, and they need each other. She worries that on some level Lauren is jealous, and there's no way to ask her that, no way to suggest the possibility, nor is there anything that Sarah can do to undo it if that is the case. Thinking of Lauren makes her think of being a kid. It's a wonderful thing to have a friend who knew you as a kid. It is the closest, of course, that she has to a sibling, a thought she doesn't like to spend too much time on, because it reminds her that she had one, a sibling, once, a long time ago, but he is dead.
Ruman Alam with us reading from his novel, Rich and Pretty. I'm going to take the perfect call here, Ruman,
okay.
Right
oh,
after
great.
That excerpt, okay? To great. Lily, driving across the country. Hi, Lily.
Hi, thank you. I'm so excited. That excerpt, we were just listening to it. My name's Lily. My best friend Violet here with me. Hi.
Hey.
We have been best friends since birth. Our moms worked together when they were pregnant, and we grew up together in Northern California. We went to school together, preschool, kindergarten, all the way through fourth grade. We went to different schools for fifth and sixth grade, back to school again in seventh and eighth grade, and then different high schools. I go to school in San Diego, back in California, but Violet goes to college at Vassar in Poughkeepsie, New York. So we're currently driving from Northern California to upstate New York, and every morning on our road trip, we turn on NPR, and this morning we're listening to your show, and it's about friendship,
I'm
and we've been
so
lifelong
glad.
And so we had to call in and say hi.
I am so glad. So you two have known each other from the very beginning, and now you're going to college together. What
yeah,
is the friendship going to be tested as you go to different schools, do you think?
No, we're entering our sophomore year in college, and I think we've actually got closer in college. She's one of the friends that I've stayed most in touch with from home. Going to different high schools, we did grow apart a little bit, but it was always one of those things where even if we didn't talk for a little bit, we could pick right back up immediately, and our families are so close. We always went camping together when we were kids, and I consider her parents my second parents, and on our
with me.
We call our moms each other's second moms, and it's really incredible to have somebody who knows you so closely and knows everyone that you grew up with. And it's just a really incredible friendship, and whenever we meet somebody, we always have to tell them that we've been friends since we were babies, and somebody else like, we go to college and read that in school that, like, oh, yeah, I've been friends with this person since first grade, and we always have to say, well, my best friend, I've been best friends since we were infants. And it's really important. And there was some part of that excerpt when he was reading, and it was about knowing, having a friend who's known you as a kid, and I think that's something that's really special to have.
I am so glad you happened to be listening on your way to school out east, and you called in. Lily and Violet, good luck with school, and thanks so much for the call.
Thank you so much.
Ruman, do you have a really close friend from college? Because I have to say, I that's where I formed friendships that I look back and say, okay, they changed me. I'm not who I am today without those friends in college.
Yes, similarly, I... Before I answer that, I just want to say how weirdly appropriate that call was.
I
because
know.
In my book, the characters go to Vassar College.
Oh, that's right.
Which is my way of nodding to a wonderful, wonderful novel called The Group by Mary McCarthy from 1963, which was a huge influence on this particular work. But yes, I share your sense that my close relationships as an undergraduate really affected the adult that I became. And I have many, many dear friends who I know from my time at Oberlin College and, you know, who have probably had a much bigger influence on me. I just didn't happen to have a best friend from birth as Lily and Violet were, which is so cute that they're both named after flowers also.
Isn't it, though? I mean, this was like meant to be, and how I think it was also meant to be that they'd be listening on this morning and hearing that excerpt. And maybe this is a moment, Ruman, with you and me, that they're going to remember in this friendship.
I hope so. It's very sweet.
Really great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For the conversation. I just loved it. Ruman Alam with us. Rich and Pretty is the title of the novel. Read all about it. It's on our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series. Lily and Violet, if you've got a little time to be reading when you're at school, check out that list. It's on the thread.